The Iron Tactician by Alistair Reynolds. Narrated by John Keating.
Merlin felt the old tension returning. As he approached the wreck, his mouth turned dry. His stomach coiled with apprehension, and he dug nails into his palms until they hurt. He sweated, and his heart raced. "If this was a trap," he said, "it would definitely have sprung by now, wouldn't it?" "What would you like me to say?" his ship asked, reasonably. "You could try setting my mind at ease. That would be a start. It's one of ours, isn't it? You can agree with me on that."
"It's a swallow ship, yes.
7 or 8 kilo-years old, at a minimum estimate. The trouble is, I can't get a clean read of the hull registry from this angle. We could send out the proctors, or I could just sweep around to the other side and take a better look. I know which would be quicker. Sometimes I think I should just let you make all the decisions."
"I already make quite a lot of them, Merlin. You just haven't noticed."
"Do whatever you need to do," he said bad-temperedly. As Tyrant swooped around the wreck, searchlights brushed across the hull like delicate questing fingertips, illuminating areas of the ship that would have been in shadow or bathed only in the weak red light of this system's dwarf star. The huge wreck was an elaborate flared cylinder, bristling with navigation systems and armaments. The cylinder's wide mouth was where it sucked in interstellar gas, compressing and processing it for fuel, before blasting it out the back in a vicious, high-energy exhaust stream. Swallow ships were ungainly, and they took forever to get up to the speed where that scoop mechanism was effective. But there was nowhere in the galaxy they couldn't reach, given time. Robust, reliable, and relatively easy to manufacture, there had been only minor changes in design and armaments across many kilo-years. Each of these ships would have been home to thousands of people, many of whom would live and die without ever setting foot on a world. There was damage, too. Holes and craters in the hull. Half the cladding missing along one great flank. Buckling to the intake petals. Beyond anything a local crew could repair. Something had found this ship and murdered it.
"There," Tyrant said. "Swallow ship Shrike. Commissioned at the High Monarch Halo Factory. 12-12-4. Cohort base time. Assigned to Deterrent Patrol out of Mother Base Ascending Raptor. Most recently under command of Pardalot. There's more, if you want it."
"No, that'll do. I've never been near any of those places. And I haven't heard of Pardalot or this ship. It's a long way from home, isn't it?"
"And not going anywhere soon."
Beyond doubt, the attacking force had been Husker, whereas a human foe might have finished this ship off completely. The Huskers were mathematically sparing in their use of force. They did precisely enough to achieve an end and then left. They must have known that there were survivors still on the ship, but the Huskers seldom took prisoners, and the continued fate of those survivors would not have concerned them. Merlin could guess, though, there would have been no chance of rescue this far from the rest of the cohort, and the damaged ship could only have kept survivors alive for a limited time. A choice of deaths, in other words. Some slow, some fast, some easier than others. He wondered which he might have chosen. "Dig me out a blueprint for that mark of swallow ship, the best you can, and find a docking port that places me as close as possible to the command desk." He touched a hand to his sternum, as if reminding himself of his own vulnerability. "Force and wisdom, but I hate ghost ships."
"Then why are you going in?"
"Because the one thing I hate more than ghost ships is not knowing where I am."
The suit felt tight in places it had never done before. His breath fogged the faceplate, his lungs already working double time. It had been weeks since he had worn the suit, maybe months, and it was telling him that he was out of shape, needing the pull of a planet's gravity to give his muscles something to work against. "All right," he said. "Open the lock. If I'm not back in an hour, find a big moon and scratch my name on it."
"Are you sure you don't want the proctors to accompany you?"
"Thanks, but I'll get this done quicker on my own." He went inside, his suit lit up with neon patches, a moving blob of light that made his surroundings both familiar and estranged at the same time. The swallow ship was huge, but he only meant to travel a short distance through its innards. Up a level, down a level. Each turn or bend taking him further from the lock and the debatable sanctuary of his own ship. He had been steeling himself for corpses, but so far there were none. That meant that there had been survivors. Not many, perhaps, but enough to gather up the dead and do something with their bodies. Slowly, Merlin accepted that the ship was all that it seemed, rather than a trap. The suit was beginning to seem less of a burden, and his breathing had settled down. He was nearly at the command deck now, and once there, it would not take him long to decide if the ship held useful information. He needed better chance. Recently, there had been a few close scrapes. A couple of turbulent stretches had damaged Tyrant's syrinx, and now each transition in and out of the waynet had Merlin praying for his last shred of good luck. Swallow ships could not use the waynet, but any decent captain would still value accurate maps of the old network. Its twinkling corridors of accelerated space-time provided cover, masking the signature of a ship if it moved on a close parallel course. The location of the waynet's major hubs and junctions was also a clue as to the presence of age-old relics and technological treasure. Merlin paused. He was passing the doorway to one of the Frostwatch vaults, where the surviving crew might have retreated as the last of their life support systems gave out. After a moment's hesitation, he pushed through into the vault. In vacuum, it was no colder or more silent than any other space he had passed through. But he seemed to feel an additional chill as he entered the chamber. The cabinets were stacked six high on opposite walls of the vault, and the vault went on much further than his lights could penetrate. Easily 100 or more sleepers in just this vault, he decided. But there would be others, spread around the ship for redundancy. Thousands in total, if the swallow ship was anything like his own. The status panels next to each cabinet were dead. And when Merlin swept the room with a thermal overlay, everything was at the same low temperature. He drifted along the cabinets, tracing the names engraved into the status panels with his fingertips. Sora. Paurake. They were common cohort names. In some cases, identical to people he had known. Some had been colleagues or friends. Others had been much more than that. He knew that if he searched these vaults long enough, he was bound to find a Merlin. It had not been such a rare name. One kindness. When these people went into Frostwatch, they must have been clinging to some thought of rescue. It would have been a slim hope, but better than none at all. He wanted to think that their last thoughts had been gentle ones. "I'm sorry no one came sooner," Merlin whispered. Although he could have shouted the words for all the difference they made. "I'm too late for you, but I'm here to witness what happened to you, and I promise you'll have your justice." Filled with disquiet, he left the vault and made his way to the command deck. The control consoles were as dead and dark as he had been expecting, but at least there were no bodies. Merlin studied the consoles for a few minutes, satisfying himself that there were no obvious booby traps, and then spooled out a cable from his suit sleeve. The cable's end was a standard cohort fixture, and it interfaced with the nearest console without difficulty. At first, all was still dead, but the suit was sending power and data pulses into the console, and after a few minutes, the console's upper surface began to glow with faint but brightening readouts. Merlin settled into a chair with his elbow on the console, and his fist jammed under his helmet ring. He expected a long wait before anything useful could be mined from the frozen architecture. Branching diagrams played across his faceplate, showing active memory registers and their supposed contents. Merlin skimmed, determined not to be distracted by anything but the charts he had come for. The lives of the crew, the cultural records they carried with them, the systems and worlds this ship had known, the battles it had fought, might have been of interest to him under other circumstances. Now was the time for a ruthless focus. He found the navigation files. There were thousands of branches to the tree, millions of documents in those branches. But his long familiarity with cohort data architecture enabled him to dismiss most of what he saw. He carried on searching, humming an old plenitude tune to cheer himself up. Gradually, he slowed and fell silent. Just as disappointment was beginning to creep in, he hit a tranche of Waynet maps that were an improvement on anything he had for this sector. Within a few seconds, the data was flowing into his suit, and onward to the memory cores of his own ship. Satisfied at last, he made to unspool. Something nagged at him. Merlin backtracked. He shuffled up and down trees until he found the set of records that had registered on his subconscious, even as his thoughts had been on the charts. Syrinx's study and analysis. Beneath that, many branches and sub-branches relating to the examination and testing of a fully active Syrinx. A pure cold shiver ran through him. Something jabbed into his back, just below the smooth hump of his life support unit. Merlin did the only thing that he could, under the circumstances, which was to turn slowly around, raising his hands in the age-old gesture. The spool stretched from his glove, uncoupled, whisked back into its housing in the wrist. Another suit looked back at him. There was a female face behind the visor, and the thing that had jabbed him was a gun. "Do you understand me?" The voice coming through in his helmet spoke Maine. The accent was unfamiliar, but he had no trouble with the meaning. Merlin swallowed and cleared his throat. "Yes." "Good. The only reason you're not dead is that you're wearing a cohort suit, not a Husker one. Otherwise, I'd have skipped this part and blown a hole right through you. Move away from the console." "I'm happy to." "Slowly." "As slow as you like." Merlin's mouth felt dry again, his windpipe tight. "I'm a friend. I'm not here to steal anything, just to borrow some of your charts." "Borrowing? Is that what you call it?" "I'd have asked if there was anyone to ask." He eased from the console and risked a slow lowering of his arms. The ship looked dead. I had no reason to assume anyone was alive. Come to think of it, how are you alive? There were no life signs, no energy sources. "Shut up." She waggled the gun. "Where are you from? Which swallow ship? Which mother base?" "I haven't come from a swallow ship or a mother base." Merlin grimaced. He could see no good way of explaining his situation, or at least none that was likely to improve the mood of this person with the gun. "I'm what you might call a freelancer. My name is Merlin." She cut him off. "If that's what you're calling yourself, I give some serious thought to picking another name. It's worked well enough for me until now. There's only one Merlin, only one that matters, anyway. He gave a self-effacing smile. Word got round, then. I suppose it was inevitable, given the time I've been travelling. Word got round, yes. There was a man called Merlin, and he left the cohort. Shall I tell you what we were taught to think of Merlin? I imagine you're going to. There are two views on him. One is that Merlin was a fool, a self-deluding braggart, with an ego to match the size of his delusion. I've never said I was a saint. The other view is that Merlin betrayed the cohort, that he stole from it and ran from the consequences, that he never had any intention of returning, that he's a liar and criminal and deserves to die for it. So the choice is yours, really, clown or traitor. Which Merlin are you? Is there a third option? No. Behind the visor, her eyes narrowed. He could only see the upper part of her face, but it was enough to tell that she was young. I don't remember exactly when you ran, but it's been thousands of years. I know that much. You could be anyone. Although, why anyone would risk passing themselves off under that name? Then that proves it's me, doesn't it? Only I'd be stupid enough to keep calling myself Merlin. He tried to appeal to the face. It has been thousands of years, but not for me. I've been travelling at near the speed of light for most of that time. Tyrant, my ship, is Waynet capable. I've been searching these files, stealing them. Searching them? I'm deep into territory I don't know well enough to trust, and I thought you might have better chance. You do as well. But there's something else. Your name, by the way. I mean, since we're having this lovely conversation. He read the hesitation in her eyes. A moment when she was on the verge of refusing him, even the knowledge of her name. As if she had no intention of him living long enough for it to matter. But something broke, and she yielded. Teal. And what do you mean, something else? In these files, mention of a Syrinx. Is it true? Did you have a Syrinx? If your ship is Waynet capable, then you already have one. Merlin nodded. Yes, but mine is damaged, and it doesn't function as well as it used to. I hit a bad kink in the Waynet, and each transition's been harder than the one before. I wasn't expecting to find one here. It was the chance that interested me. But now I know what I've stumbled on. You'll steal it. No, borrow it, on the implicit understanding that I'm continuing to serve the ultimate good of the cohort. Teal, you must believe me. There's a weapon out there that can shift the balance in this war. To find it, I need Tyrant, and Tyrant needs a Syrinx. Then I have some bad news for you. We sold it. Her tone was offhand, dismissive. It was a double star system, a few lights back the way we'd come. We needed repairs, material, parts the Swallow ship couldn't make for itself. We made contact, sent in negotiators. I was on the diplomatic party. We bartered. We left them the Syrinx, and Pardalote got the things we needed. Merlin turned aside in disgust. You idiots! Teal swiped the barrel of the gun across his faceplate. Merlin flinched back, wondering how close she had been to just shooting him there and then. Don't judge us. And don't judge Pardalote for the decisions she took. You weren't there, and you haven't the faintest idea what we went through. Shall I tell you how it was for me? Merlin wisely said nothing. There's a vault near the middle of the ship. Teal went on. The best place to hide power if you're going to use it. One by one, our Frostwatch cabinets failed us. There were 1,000 of us, then 100, then the last 10. Each time we woke up, counted how many of us were still alive, drew straws to see who got the cabinets that were still working. There were always less and less. I'm the last one, the last of us to get a working cabinet. I ran it on a trickle of power, just the bare minimum. Set the cabinet to wake me if anyone came near. Merlin waited a moment, then nodded. Can I make a suggestion? If it makes you feel better. My ship is warm, it has air, and it's still capable of moving. I feel we'd get to a position of trust a lot quicker if we could speak face to face, without all this glass and vacuum between us. He caught her sneer. What makes you think I'd ever trust you? People come round to me, Merlin said. The Syrinx was a matte black cone about as long as Merlin was tall. It rested in a cradle of metal supports, sharp end pointing aft, in a compartment just forward of Tyrant's engine bay. Syrinxes seemed to work better when they were somewhere close to the centre of mass of a ship. But beyond that, there were no clear rules, and much of what was known had been pieced together through guesswork and experimentation. It still works, to a degree, Merlin said, stroking a glove along the tapering form. But it's dying on me. I daren't say how many more transits I'll get out of it. What would you have done if it had failed? Teal asked, managing to make the question sound peremptory and businesslike, as if she had no real interest in the answer. They had taken off their helmets, but were still wearing the rest of their suits. Merlin had closed the airlock, but kept Tyrant docked with the larger ship. He had shown Teal through the narrow warren of his linked living quarters without stopping to comment, keen to show her that at least the Syrinx was a verifiable part of his story. I doubt I'd have had much time to worry about it if it failed. Probably ended up as an interesting smear, that's all. Merlin offered a smile, but Teal's expression remained hard and unsympathetic. A quick death's nothing to complain about. She was a hard one for him to fathom. Her head looked too small, too childlike, jutting out from the neck ring of her suit. She was short-haired, hard-boned, tough, and wiry-looking at the same time. He had been right about her eyes, even through the visor. They had seen too much pain and hardship, bottled too much of it inside themselves, and now it was leaking back out. You still don't trust me, and that's fine. But let me show you something else. Merlin beckoned her back through into the living area, then made one of the walls light up with images and maps and text from his private files. The collage was dozens of layers deep, with the records and annotations in just as many languages and alphabets. What is this supposed to prove? He skimmed rectangles aside, flicking them to the edge of the wall. Here were Waynet charts, maps of solar systems, schematics of the surfaces of worlds and moons. The thing I'm looking for, he said, the weapon, the gun, whatever you want to call it, this is everything that I've managed to find out about it. Clues, rumours, whispers, from 100 worlds. Maybe they don't all point to the same thing. I'd be amazed if they did. But some of them do, I'm sure of it. And before long, I'm going to find the piece that ties the whole thing together. He stabbed a finger at a nest of numbers next to one of the charts. Look how recent these time tags are, Teal. I'm still searching, still gathering evidence. Her face was in profile, bathed in the different colours of the images. The slope of her nose, the angle of her chin, reminded him in certain small ways of Sayaka. She turned to him sharply, as if she'd been aware of his gaze. "I saw pictures of you," Teal said. "They showed us them in War Crash. They were a warning against irresponsibility. You look much older than you did in those pictures. Travel broadens the mind. It also puts a large number of lines on you." He nodded at the collage of records. "I'm no angel, and I've made mistakes. But this proves I'm still committed. Which means we're both in the same boat, doesn't it? Lone survivors, forced together, each needing to trust the other. Are you really the last of your crew?" There was a silence before she answered. "Yes. I knew it before I went under, the last time. There were still others around, but mine was the last reliable cabinet, the only one that stood a chance of working." "You were chosen to have the best chance?" "Yes." He nodded, thinking again of those inner scars. "Then I've a proposition." He raised a finger, silencing her before she could get a word out. "The Huskers did something terrible to you and your people, as they did mine. They deserve to be punished for that, and they will be. Together, we can make it happen." "By finding your fabled weapon?" "By finding the Syrinx that'll help me carry on with my search. You said that system wasn't far away. If it's on the Waynet, I can reach it in Tyrant. We backtrack. If you traded with them once, we can trade again. You've seen that system once before, so you have the local knowledge I most certainly lack." She glanced away, her expression clouded by very obvious misgivings. "We sold them a Syrinx," Teal said. "One of the rarest, strangest things ever made. All you have is a little black ship and some stories. What could you ever offer them that would be worth that?"
"I'd think of something," Merlin said.
The transition, when it came, was the hardest so far. Merlin had been expecting the worst, and had made sure the two of them were buckled in as tightly as their couches allowed, side by side in Tyrant's command deck. When they slipped into the Waynet, it had felt like an impact, a solid scraping blow against the ship, as if it were grinding its way along the flank of an asteroid or iceberg. Alarms sounded, and the hull gave off moans and shrieks of structural complaint. Tyrant yawed violently. Probes and stabilizers flaked away from the hull, but it held. Merlin waited for the instruments to settle down, and for the normal smooth motion of the flow to assert itself. Only then did he start breathing again. "We're all right. Once we're in the way, it's rarely too bad. It's just coming in and out that's becoming problematic." Long experience told him it was safe to unbuckle, and he motioned for Teal to do likewise. She had kept her suit on and her helmet nearby, as if either of those things stood any chance of protecting her if the transition failed completely. Merlin had removed all but the clothes he normally wore in Tyrant, baggy and tending to frills and ornamentation. "How long until we come out again?" Merlin squinted at one of the indicators. "About 6 hours. We're moving very quickly now. Only about 100 billionth part less than the speed of light. Do you see those circles that shoot past us every second?" They were like the glowing ribs of a tunnel, whisking to either side in an endless hypnotic procession. "What are they?" "Constraining hoops, anchored back into fixed space. They pin down the way, keep it flowing in the right direction. In reality, they're about 8 light hours apart.
Far enough that you could easily drop a solar system between them. I think about the Waymakers a lot, you know. They made an empire so old that by the time it fell, hardly anyone remembered anything that came before it. Light and wealth and all the sunsets anyone could ever ask for.
Look at all the good it did them, Teal said. We're like rats, hunting for crumbs in the ruins they left us.
Even rats have their day, Merlin said. And speaking of crumbs, would you like something to eat?
What sort of rations do you have?
He patted his belly. We run to a bit more than rations on Tyrant. With the ship weightless, still rushing down the throat of the way, they ate with their legs tucked under them in the glass eye of the forward observation bubble. Merlin eyed Teal between mouthfuls, noticing how entirely at ease she was with the absence of gravity, never needing to chase a gobbet of food or a stray blob of water. She had declined his offer of wine, but Merlin saw no need to put himself through such hardship.
Tell me about the people you traded with, he said.
They were fools, Teal said.
She carried on eating for a few mouthfuls, but useful fools. They had what we needed, and we had something they considered valuable.
Fools? Why exactly?
They were at war, an interplanetary conflict, fought using fusion ships and fusion bombs. Strategy, shaped by artificial intelligences on both sides. It had been going on for centuries when we got there, with only intervals of peace, when the military computers reached a stalemate. Just enough time to rebuild before they started blowing each other to hell again. Two worlds, circling different stars of a binary system, and all the other planets and moons caught up in it in one way or another. A twisted, factional mess. And stupid, too. She stabbed her fork into the rations, as if her meal was something that needed killing.
Huskers aren't thick in this sector, but you don't go around making noise and light if you've any choice, and there's always a choice.
We don't seem to have much choice about this war we're in, Merlin said.
We're different.
Her eyes were hard and cold. This is species-level survival. Their stupid interplanetary war was over trivial ideology, old grudges, sustained and fanned. Men and women willingly handing their fates to battle computers. Pardalot was reluctant to do business with them, too hard to know who to speak to, who to trust. Merlin made a pained, studious look.
I'd never meddle in someone else's war.
She pushed the fork around.
In the end, it wasn't too bad.
We identified the side best placed to help us, and got in and out before there were too many complications.
Complications?
There weren't any. Not in the end. She was silent for a second or two.
I was glad to leave that stupid place. I've barely thought about them since.
Your logs say you were in that system 1,300 years ago. A lot could have changed since then. Who knows? Maybe they've patched up their differences.
And maybe the Huskers found them.
You know what, Teal? Your cheerful company.
Seeing the rest of your crew die will do that. You chose to leave, Merlin. It wasn't that you were the last survivor.
He sipped at his wine, debating how much of a clear head he would need when they emerged from the way. Sometimes a clear head was the last thing that helped.
I lost good people as well, Teal.
Really? He pushed off, moved to a cabinet, and drew out a pair of immersion suits.
If you went through War Crash, you'll know what these are. Do you trust me enough to put one on? Teal took the dun-coloured garment and studied it with unveiled distaste. What good will this do? Put it on. I want to show you what I lost. We'll win this war in reality, not simulations. There's nothing you can show me that... Just do it, Teal. She scowled at him, but went into a back room of Tyrant to remove her own clothes and don the tight-fitting immersion suit. By the time she was ready, Merlin had slipped into the other suit. He nodded at Teal as she spidered back into the cabin. Good. Trust is good. We'll only be inside a little while, but I think it'll help. Chip, patch us through.
The palace, Merlin.
Where else? The suit prickled his neck as it established its connection with his spine. There was the usual moment of dislocation, and Tyrant melted away, to be replaced by a surrounding of warm stone walls and tall fretted windows, shot through with amber sun. Teal was standing next to him.
Where are we?
Where I was born. Where my brother and I spent the first couple of decades of our existence, before the cohort came. Merlin walked to the nearest window and bid Teal to follow him. Gallinul created this environment long after we left. He's gone now as well. So this is a reminder of the past for me in more ways than one.
Your brother's dead?
It's complicated. She left it at that. What world are we on? Plenitude, we called it. Common enough name, I suppose. Merlin stepped onto a plinth under the window, offering a better view through its fretwork. Do you see the land below? Teal strained to look down. It's moving, sliding under us. I thought we were in a castle or something. We are. The Palace of Eternal Dusk. My family home for 1300 years. As long as the interval between your visits to that system. He touched his hand against the stonework. We didn't make this place. It was unoccupied for centuries, circling plenitude at exactly the same speed as the line between day and night. My family were the first to reach it from the surface, using supersonic aircraft. We held it for the next 40 generations. He lifted his face to the unchanging aspect of the sun, hovering at its fixed position over the endlessly flowing horizon. My uncle was a bit of an amateur archaeologist. He dug deep into the rock the palace is built on, as far down as the anti-gravity keel. He said he found evidence that it was at least 20,000 years old, and maybe quite a bit more than that. Merlin touched a hand to Teal's shoulder. Let me show you something else. She flinched under his touch, but allowed him to steer her to one of the parlours branching off the main room. Merlin halted them both at the door, touching a finger to his lips. Two boys knelt on a carpet in the middle of the parlour, their forms sidelit by golden light. They were surrounded by toy armies, spread out in ordered regiments and platoons. Gallinul and I, Merlin whispered, as the younger of the boys took his turn to move a mounted and pennanted figure from one flank to another. Dreaming of war, little did we know we'd get more than our share of it. He backed away, leaving the boys to their games, and took Teal to the next parlour. Here an old woman sat in a stern black chair, facing one of the sunlit windows, with her face mostly averted from the door. She wore black and had her hands in her lap, keeping perfectly still and watchful. Years later, Merlin said, Gallinul and I were taken from plenitude. It was meant to be an act of kindness, preserving something of our world in advance of the Huskers. But it tore us from our mother. We couldn't return to her. She was left here with the ruins of empire, her sons gone, her world soon to fall. The woman seemed aware of her visitors,
She turned slightly, bringing more of her face into view. Her eyes searched the door, as if looking for ghosts.
"She has a gentle look," Teal said quietly.
"She was kind,"
Merlin answered softly.
They spoke ill of her, but they didn't know her. Not the way Galanul and I did. The woman slowly turned back to face the window. Her face was in profile again, her eyes glistening.
"Does she ever speak?"
"She's no cause to."
Merlin's mouth was dry for a few moments.
"We saw it happen, from the Swallow Ship.
Saw the Husker weapons strike plenitude. Saw the fall of the Palace of Eternal Dusk."
Merlin turned from the tableau of his mother.
"I mean to go back one of these days. See what's left with my own eyes. But I find it hard to bring myself to."
"How many died?"
Teal asked.
"Hundreds of millions. We were the only two that Quail managed to save, along with a few fragments of cultural knowledge. So I know what it's like, Teal. Believe me, I know what it's like."
He turned from her with a cold disregard.
"Chip, bring Teal out."
"What about you?"
"I need a little time on my own. You can start remembering everything I need to know about the binary system. You've got about 5 hours.
Tyrant pulled Teal out of the palace.
Merlin stood alone, silent, for long moments.
Then he returned to the parlour where his mother watched the window, imprisoned in an endless golden day. And he stood in her shadow, wondering what it would take to free her from that reverie of loss and loneliness. They made a safe emergence from the waynet, Merlin holding his breath until they were out and stable, and the syrinx had stopped ringing in its cradle like a badly cracked bell. He took a few minutes to assess their surroundings. 2 stars. Close enough together for fusion ships to make a crossing between them in weeks. 12 large worlds, scattered evenly between the 2 stars. 100s of moons and minor bodies. 1000s of moving ships, easily tracked across interplanetary distance. The vessels grouped into squadrons and attack formations. Battle stations and supercarriers. Fortresses and cordons. The occasional flash of a nuclear weapon or energy pulse weapon. Battle ongoing. Tyrant was stealthy, but even a stealthy ship made a big splash coming out of the waynet. Merlin wasn't at all surprised when a large vessel locked onto them and closed in fast, presumably pushing its fusion engines to the limit. Teal carried on briefing him as the ship approached.
"I don't like the look of that thing,"
Tyrant said, as soon as they had a clear view.
"I don't either," Merlin said. "We'll treat it respectfully. Wouldn't want you getting a scratch on your paintwork, would we?"
The vessel was 3 times as large as Merlin's ship, and every inch a thing of war. Guns bristled from its hull. It was made of old alloys, forged and joined by venerable methods, and its engines and weapons depended on the antique alchemy of magnetically bottled fusion. A snarling mouth that had been painted across the front of the ship, crammed with razor-tipped teeth.
"It's a Havergal ship," Teal said. "That's their marking, that dagger and star. It doesn't look all that different to the ships they had when we were here before."
"Fusion's a plateau technology," Merlin remarked. "If all they ever needed to do was get around this binary system and blow each other up now and then, it would have been sufficient." "They knew about the waynet, of course. Hard to miss it, cutting through their sky the way it does. That interested them. They wanted to jump all the way from fusion to syrinx technology, without all the hard stuff in between."
"Doesn't look like they got very far, does it?"
The angry-looking ship
drew alongside. An airlock opened, and a squad of armoured figures came out on rocket packs. Merlin remained tense, but commanded Tyrant's weapons to remain inside their hatches. He also told the proctors to hide themselves away until he needed them. Footfalls clanged onto the hull. Grappling devices slid like nails on rust. Merlin opened his airlock, nodded at Teal, and the two of them went to meet the boarding party. He was halfway there when a thought occurred to him. Unless they bring up your earlier visit, don't mention it. You're just along for the ride with me. I want to know if there's anything they say or do that doesn't fit with your picture of them. Anything they might be keeping from me.
I speak their language. Isn't that going to take some explaining?
Feign ignorance to start with. Then make it seem as if you're picking it up as you go. If they get suspicious, we'll just say that there are a dozen other systems in this sector where they speak a similar dialect. He flashed a nervous smile at Teal. Or something. Make it up. Be creative. The airlock had cycled by the time they arrived. When it opened, Merlin was not surprised to find only two members of the boarding party inside. There would not have been room for more. Welcome, he said, making a flourishing gesture of invitation. Come in, come in. Take your shoes off. Make yourselves at home. They were a formidable-looking pair. Their vacuum armour had a martial look to it, with bladed edges and spurs, a kind of stabbing ram on the crowns of their helmets, fierce-looking grills across the glass of their faceplates. All manner of guns and close combat weapons buckled or braced to the armour. The armour was green, with gold ornamentation. Merlin tapped his throat. Take your helmets off. The worst you'll catch is a sniffle. They came into the ship. Their faces were lost behind the grills. But he caught the movement as they twisted to look at each other, before reaching up to undo their helmets. They came free with a tremendous huff of equalizing pressure, revealing a pair of heads. There were two men, both bald, with multiple blemishes and battle scars across their scalps. They had tough, grizzled-looking features, with lantern jaws and a dusting of dark stubble across their chins and cheeks. A dueling scar or similar across the face of one man, a laser burn ruining the ear of the other. Their small, cold-seeming eyes were pushed back into a sea of wrinkles. One man opened his mouth, revealing a cage of yellow and metal teeth. He barked out something, barely a syllable. His voice was very deep, and Merlin caught a blast of stale breath as he spoke. The other man waited a moment, then amplified this demand or greeting with a few more syllables of his own. Merlin returned these statements with an uneasy smile of his own. I'm Merlin, he said. And I come in peace, ish.
They don't understand you,
Teal whispered. I'm damned glad they don't. Did you get anything of what they said?
They want to know why you're here and what you want.
The first man said a few more words, still in the same angry, forceful tone as before. The second man glanced around and touched one of the control panels next to the airlock. Isn't war lovely? Merlin said.
I understand them,
Teal said, still in a whisper. Well enough, anyway. They're still using the main Havergal language. It's shifted a bit, but I can still get the gist. How much do you want me to pretend to understand? Nothing yet. Keep soaking it in. When you think you've given it long enough, point to the two of us and make the sound for friend. Merlin grinned back at the suited men, the two of them edging away from the lock in opposite directions.
I know. It needs a little work, doesn't it? Tired decor. I'm thinking of knocking out this wall. Maybe putting a window in over there. Teal said something, jabbing one hand at her chest and another at Merlin.
Friendly, she said. I've told them we're friendly. What else?
Give them our names. Then tell them we'd like to speak to whoever's in charge of that planet you mentioned. He caught Merlin and Teal and the name Havergal. He had to trust that she was doing a good job of making her initial efforts seem plausibly imperfect, even as she stumbled into ever-improving fluency. Whatever she had said, though, it had a sudden and visible effect. The crag-faced men came closer together again and now directed their utterances at Teal alone, guessing that was the only one who had any kind of knowledge of their language.
What? Merlin asked.
They're puzzled that I speak their tongue. They also want to know if you have a syrinx.
Tell them I have a syrinx, but that it doesn't work very well. Merlin was still smiling at the men, but the muscles around his mouth were starting to ache. And tell them I apologize for not speaking their tongue. But you're much better at languages than me. What are their names, too?
I'll ask.
There was another halting exchange, Merlin sensing that the names were given grudgingly, but she drew them out in the end.
Baylus, Teal said, and Locrian. I'd tell you which is which, but I'm not sure there'd be much point.
Good. Thank Baylus and Locrian for the friendly reception. Tell them that they are very welcome on my ship, but I'd be very obliged if the others stopped crawling around outside my hull. Merlin paused. Oh, and one other thing. Ask them if they're still at war with Gefurius. He had no need of Teal to translate the answer to that particular part of his query. Baylus, or perhaps Locrian, made a hawking sound, as if he meant to spit. Merlin was glad that he did not deliver on the gesture. The intention had been transparent enough.
He says, Teal replied, that the Gefurians broke the terms of the recent treaty, and the one before that, and the one before that.
He said the Gefurians have the blood of pigs in their veins. He also says that he would rather cut out his own tongue than speak of the Gefurians in polite company. One or two bridges to build there, then. He also asks why they should care what you think of the ones still on your hull. It's a fair question. How good do you think you're getting with this language of theirs?
Better than I'm letting on.
Well, let's push our luck a little. Tell Baylus, or Locrian, that I have weapons on this ship. Big, dangerous weapons. Weapons neither of them will have ever seen before. Weapons that, if they understood their potency, and how near they've allowed that ship of theirs to come, would make them empty their bowels so quickly they'd fill their own spacesuits up to the neck ring. Can you do that for me?
How about I tell them that you're armed, that you're ready to defend your property, but that you still want to proceed from a position of peaceful negotiation?
On balance, probably for the best.
I'll also add that you've come to find out about a syrinx, and you're prepared to discuss terms of trade.
Do that.
Merlin waited while this laborious exchange was carried on.
Teal reached some sort of critical juncture in her statement, and this drew a renewed burst of angry exclamations from Baylus and Locrian. He guessed they had just been acquainted with the notion that Tyrant was armed. But Teal continued, and her words appeared to have some temporary soothing effect, or as best as could be expected. Merlin raised his hands in his best placating manner. Honestly, I'm not the hair-trigger type. We just need to have a basis for mutual respect here.
Cohort?
He heard one of them say. Yes, he answered, at the same time as Teal. Cohort. Big, bad cohort.